Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. America, all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 2th of August, Anno Domini 2014, and you, ho-ho, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
What's the tooth?
The tooth. It is the 2th of August.
The tooth?
Yeah.
And then tomorrow's the tooth?
The tooth? Four.
I didn't worry about that tomorrow. Today is the tooth.
Yeah, let's hear you go through the rest of the month.
Okay. It's 5 after the hour. We're going to be bringing you news, use, blah, blah. You know that. Computer users pass around USB sticks like silicon business cards. Although we know they often carry malware infections, we depend on antivirus scans and the occasional reformatting to keep our thumb drives from becoming the carrier for the next digital epidemic. But the security problems with USB devices runs deeper than you think. The risk isn't just in what they carry. It's built into the core of how they work. That's the takeaway from finding security researchers Karsten Knoll and Jacob Lell plan to present this week, demonstrating a collection of proof-of-concept malicious software that highlights how the security of USB devices has long been fundamentally broken. The malware they created, called Bad USB, can be installed on a USB device to completely take over a PC, invisibly alter files installed from the memory stick, and even redirect the user's internet traffic. Because bad USB resides not in the flash memory storage of USB devices, but in the firmware that controls their basic functions, the attack code can remain hidden long after the contents of the device's memory would appear to the average user to be deleted. And the two researchers say there's no easy fix. The kind of compromise they're demonstrating is nearly impossible to counter without banning the sharing of USB devices or filling your port with superglue. These problems can't be patched, said Knoll, who will join Lell in presenting the research at the Black Hat Security Conference in Las Vegas. We're exploiting the very way that USB is designed. Knoll and Lell, researchers for the security consultancy SR Labs, are hardly the first to point out the USB devices can store and spread malware, but the two hackers didn't merely copy their own custom-coded infections into USB devices' memory. They spent months reverse-engineering the firmware that runs the basic communication functions of USB devices, the controller chips that allow the devices to communicate with the PC and let users move files on and off them. Their central finding is the USB firmware, which exists in various forms in all USB devices, can be reprogrammed to hide attack code in the firmware. You can give it to your IT security people. They scan it, delete some files, give it back to you, telling you it's clean, said Knoll. But unless the IT guy has the reverse engineering skills to find and analyze that firmware, the cleaning process doesn't even touch the files we're talking about. So, our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that's bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is: the security of USB is broken, and your choices are: I never share USB drives, I pretend to be careful, I share them all the time, and I can't find a USB port on my flip phone. So far, I never share USB devices has been voted on 60% of them so far, followed by I pretend to be careful, I share them all the time, and I can't find a USB port on my flip phone. Now, when you're done with that, I know you're going to have more to say. So scroll down on the right there in the column under fascinating stuff, you'll see the forums. And if you go to the forums, you'll see that the second forum is the poll discussion. And if you click on that, the number one thing there is 2AUG14, the security of USB is broken. So far, we have only two discussions there, and there you are.
You know what? USB device folks pass around constantly.
Yeah.
Are flash drives.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. But the better one, if we mentioned this years ago, because I started using one, hell, it's got to be at least 8-9 years ago, was a flash drive, but it has an SD card in it. Now, the advantage of that, it's a little bulkier. You know, it's not as slim as, you know, say, the flash drive that I've got here. But with the SD card, the SD card still has the capabilities of locking and unlocking.
Right.
For you folks that don't know what that means, is it means I can put files on there.
That little slide thing you used to have on your floppy disk.
Yeah, you can slide it and lock it. So now, when I put that into your machine, there is no way I can get, you know, I can get anything from your machine. Because that was one thing critical in our business, you know, working
However,
on people's computers.
If your USB drive itself, the firmware that, you know, when you plug a USB drive in, there's firmware on that card. If that's been infected, then you will infect their machine.
Yeah, so this is the firmware right in the USB card. And that's how...
In the USB stick.
Yeah,
yeah,
right.
In the stick.
That's how the Stuxnet virus got infected the Iranian computer nuclear plants. It's just throw USB keys on the ground. People's going to pick it up, and our natural inclination is put it into your computer. Yeah. Oh, maybe I can find out whose it is and give it back to them.
And they're so cheap now. Yep. That's the thing. Yeah, they can infect so many machines and take down so much, just like you say, Steve, just by simply leaving them around. Who isn't going to grab one?
Right.
I'm sorry. That's just a lot of folks' nature.
Right. And with this, what they're saying is you can, using the standard tools we all use, you can scan it all day long. You'll never see this because it's not on the drive.
Yep.
It's in the firmware.
Yeah, it's hidden.
And so even erasing the drive doesn't remove the problem.
Right.
It's hiding in the firmware.
It's still in the code.
Right.
And every time we talk about firmware updates, you know, your hard drive can have a firmware update, your computer, a BIOS update. The bad guys can inject viruses into that BIOS. In fact, I was just listening to Security Now podcast about that, and the NSA was selling packages to break into Cisco and Juniper routers.
Yep.
Because they have reverse engineered the firmware. They put out a fake firmware update that, in addition to being all the regular, here's how your router works, there's extra codes in there to do, you know, dump all the usernames, dump all the locations, dump everything we want out of it.
One of the interesting things that seems to be happening in Chromebooks is that every time there's an update, there's a CRC check.
Mm-hmm.
And the probability...
Explain the CRC.
A CRC check, a cyclic redundancy check is what it is. So it's just a CRC. What it is when you create something, you give it a, you run it through an algorithm which produces a number called a hash. The likelihood that two different files would have the same hash are quintillions to one. So if there comes down an update, it gets checked against the hash, and if it's different, it doesn't install.
But most, so all the big companies put out CRC or the hash value. So IT managers will check that before they download something.
Right.
Average folks won't.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So they need to embed that in.
Chromebook does it itself.
Right. They have to start embedding that into the operating systems.
Right.
Unless the firmware gets patched before that.
Right. All right. And if you have anything you'd like to talk about, give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or toll free, 1-800-790-0415.
There have been a lot of stories that have come out, some from the Snowden leaks and some from other leaks, about the NSA pressuring companies going into the back door and say, make a back door for us. In fact, there was a huge allegation that RSA took millions of dollars from the NSA to intentionally weaken the original ciphers.
Right.
That's what was it? It was originally supposed to be a 128-bit cipher. And, you know, this is 20 years ago when 128-bit was enough.
Right.
And NSA said, no, let's make it 64-bit.
Yeah.
And then they said, wait a minute, that's still too much. Can you make it less? And the programmer said, no, 64-bit, that's a power of two. Our algorithms are all based on that. Okay, how about you make the last 10 digits a zero? Well, okay, we can do that.
Yeah.
So it's 54 bits, and that's ridiculously easy to break now. So a lot of the very early encryptions can be broken very easily now because of advances in computer technology.
Right.
So that's one of the concerns about the NSA capturing data. You know, today with 2048 and 4096 bit encryption, they may not be able to break it. But in 5 years,
who knows?
I mean, they might be able to.
You never say never.
Yeah. Right. And back then, you're right, 128 bit was not only a lot, but also computers were so slow that it still took a significant amount of time.
Yeah, they take
now,
about
4096 bit encryption still happens like that. So
Well, like
decryption. Rather.
What was it I saw? They were saying a statistic, you know, those cards that you open up now and they play tunes and everything else, you know, music and all that stuff. They say there's more technology and power in that card than when the first computers actually came out.
Yep.
Yep.
If you've got a digital watch, you've got more power in there than they used to get to the moon.
That's the usual comparison. More power than they used to get to the moon. And you know, the 45th anniversary of the moon landing was recently too. When you're listening to the tapes, they keep mentioning errors. There's a 1201 error, 1202 error. So people looked up what those errors meant. The error means the computer's getting too much data from the radar. I can't handle it, so I'm going to just dump it all.
You're halfway between here and
the landing radar was generating too much data to fit in the 4K buffer their computer had.
Yes.
Jeez.
And
apparently you could just dump some and still land.
Well, it's one of the reasons Neil had to take manual control is the radar was sending them toward the asteroid field. And then the numbers at the end, 60 seconds, 30 seconds. That's how much fuel he had left.
Yeah.
He touched down with 8 seconds of fuel left.
Yeah, pretty amazing stuff.
We're going to land one way or the other.
That's right.
It's either going to be a good landing or a very hard landing.
Soft landing or not. Yeah.
Right. But we did those things back in those days, and now we don't.
I wonder, still gravity. You know, there was no gravity, so.
Well, there was a little gravity.
Yeah, not much,
one-sixth of the air, but yeah. So they'll still land. It's just they want to control their descent.
The impact,
they want to land in such a way that it's upright and they can take off again.
They're not 12 feet under, only 4 feet underneath the ground.
I think one of the emergency procedures might have been to blow the ascent engines. Just dump the descent module and do an emergency ascent.
Yeah.
If we're not going to land properly.
Yeah, pretty amazing stuff. My hat's off to those people. They did it on baling wire and spit, and it was great. Now we don't do that at all anymore, of course.
Some of the new lunar probes.
We don't care.
The Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter that's taking very high-res pictures of the moon, it found the tracks from the rovers. It found they think they found all of the descent modules, pictures of them from orbit.
Oh, cool.
Yep.
Yeah, you know, that's one thing I miss. Because I did enjoy when they were working, especially on the space lab.
Mm-hmm.
I always looked forward to when the next piece was going to go up and they were going to add this on.
It became so routine that nobody cared anymore. In fact, they talked about that in fact, I just brought up a picture from Wikipedia. In the Apollo 13 movie where Jim Lovell is doing a science class on the way to the moon. And the networks aren't bothering to carry it because by Apollo 13, 11 was the landing. By 13, it's no big deal, and the networks won't even carry it.
Yeah.
Until the emergency.
Now, of course, we have the NASA TV channel.
NASA TV, you can watch.
And there's not that much to see on it.
That's pretty dry, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
what are we doing? We're sending robots and probes. Yeah.
It's a car driving on the moon. And from one aspect, it's a car driving on the moon.
Exactly.
From the other, it's just a car driving
on the moon. But are they even building any more parts onto the space station?
I think it's pretty done.
They might be. We're not. The United States is not adding any modules.
I know. The
Russian Soyuz launch vehicle is still going. SpaceX has resupplied the space station, I think, three or four times now.
Right.
The U.S. has no launch capability at the moment.
None.
So SpaceX is working on a manned version of their Dragon module.
Right.
But that was almost the same thing that happened with Shuttle. Skylab came down because the shuttle wasn't ready yet. The shuttle was supposed to bring Skylab back.
Right.
Intact, but the shuttle wasn't ready yet. Now, you know, the shuttle ended because its life was pretty much over, and we don't have the next thing ready yet. We were supposed to have, but we don't.
No, we're not going to. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 19 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. It's Soundbites on the truly great and solely member-supported Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more Soundbites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enner.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 24 minutes after the hour, we have Linda from Greece on the line. Welcome, Linda. What's up?
Hi. How's your G5, Nick?
It's only magnificent, Linda. Thank you so much. It's great.
Oh, remember the pictures? The pictures were in Google Picasa.
Oh, excellent, then.
Yeah, because remember I called you and I said something about, you know, they were in Google Picasa.
There you go. Good.
Okay. Now the question I've got. I had my computer fixed and I brought it into my, everything works fine. But one of my USB ports on the front of it will not work all of a sudden. What could be that?
Only one of them or all of them on the front?
No, I've got two on the front. The one to the right is fine because I just got into iTunes. The one on the left doesn't work all of a sudden.
I would have thought maybe
iTunes won't recognize it.
Well, it's one of two things, Linda. Either somebody didn't plug something in when they fixed your computer.
Okay.
Or that particular USB port is itself broken.
Okay.
The problem with USB ports, of course, is that they're fairly fragile.
Okay.
And we all tend to yank plugs out and do stuff like that. And
Mama always told you not to wiggle the plug when you pulled it in or out.
That's exactly, and she was right.
Yeah.
So what we all end up breaking one or at some point or another. The first thing I would do is take it back to whoever did the work and ask them to check and see that all the plugs are in correctly.
Okay.
So every time you open a PC up, there's just zillions of wires running everywhere. And I did a power supply for a customer this morning, and there were these three little tiny thin wires that went from, I think it was the audio board, to snake around the power supply cable. And I've been so careful not to yank on one of those while I'm trying to get the giant power supply cable out.
Right.
Yeah. I got to tell you, Nick.
Yeah.
My Samsung Galaxy S4 bit the dust.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Oh, no. Don't be sorry. Guess what? I have an LG G3 now.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah, well, you know, I had to have a cell phone, so, but I'm glad you enjoyed the G. Did you tell Dave about the G5?
I did. He's seen it. He likes it.
What, you mean the S5?
You got a newer one than he does.
Yep, you do. I do.
Well, that's the way the Android market works. You wait a week, there's a newer phone.
That's exactly. Right. Well, Linda, Linda, before we go any farther, if that USB slot is actually broken, and you really need more than one USB slot in the front of your machine, you can add a USB hub plugged into that front USB port that's still working.
Right, but if that hub, okay, let me ask you a question. If that hub is broken and I plug something into it, then I tried to plug my iTunes into my iTunes, will that still not work?
You have to plug it into the USB port that is working on the front.
I got you. Okay, yeah. Well, does Best Buy have those?
Yes. You can get.
So I got to ask for a USB hub.
Right. Now, there are two kinds, unpowered and powered. Powered is better.
Because it comes with its own power cord.
It comes with its own little power cord, so you would then plug that into another empty jack on your power strip. But you also can get 4-port hubs, 8-port hubs, however many ports you want.
Uh-huh.
And so although you may only have two on the front, you could end up being able to use 4, 8, or however many you want to buy.
Yeah, and what's the other one? Because I don't think, because I have my computer, my monitor, And I also have a neat receipt thing. I don't think I have any more.
Yeah, typically a keyboard and mouse might be USB. A printer might be USB.
I don't have any more slots on my, what am I trying to say?
On your power strip.
Yeah, exactly. I don't have any more. So what was the other one you mentioned?
Get a bigger power
unpowered.
Strip.
What?
Unpowered.
Unpowered. Is that just as good?
Well, the big difference is if you've got something that you charge from USB.
Oh, no.
It's like
you're... anything. I've got my power strip in my other room that I charge everything on.
Well, your iPod probably can't connect to an unpowered hub because it needs to draw power. So if you have devices like a printer with its own power cord, that can go onto an unpowered hub. But if you have a device like a phone or an MP3 player that doesn't have a separate power cord, then you need a powered hub. So you might need to get a power strip with more sockets on it too.
It plugs into the outlet. I got it from HSN, and it has four or five slots on it. You know, it wasn't a power strip. It was just something that plugged into the power.
Yeah. Yeah, those are pretty common. Some of the better ones, the outlets will be spaced farther apart, so you can put the bigger power bricks on it that a lot of things do.
I've got one of those in my TV room. That's great.
Those are good, yeah. Usually you plug a brick into a power strip, and it takes up three outlets because they're so close together.
Yeah, QVC had this one. I know which one you're talking about. You can bend it into a horseshoe.
Yes, they've got those, too. They have some very nice ones now. Those are just some choices. Think about them. And you can figure out which way you want to go.
Okay.
I would suggest
enjoy your phone.
What?
Enjoy your phone.
I am, and I will. Thank you so much.
Okay, have a good day, gentlemen.
You too. Bye bye.
There's one called the Power Squid, and it looks like a squid. It's got the main body, and then all these tentacles hanging off.
That's... I bought seven of those off of Woot. I have one.
Yeah.
Six will be in a dorm room.
Ooh, the calamari edition, the ultimate power squid.
Yeah, it's instead of a strip with plugs in it, it's five or seven, however many it is, little cords at the end of which is an individual plug. So you can separate them out and put bricks on them, and they're spread out enough that they work. Like I said, I bought seven of them. I have one.
See, how many does Elaine have?
One. And guess where the other five are?
Cat didn't need one last I knew. The two dogs didn't need it.
Dogs don't need any.
Anybody at the coffee shop?
Nobody at the coffee shop is using one.
How about this young lady that claims she's your daughter?
That's the one. So I went looking for
five of them.
Yeah. Well, she's got one in each outlet in the her dorm room. There's three outlets.
What is she doing? Running Francesco Computer Central?
There's two girls in one dorm room. 10 outlets is not enough. I don't look.
Yeah, I know.
That's when you see the dials on the meter going, wah!
Exactly. I don't care because they're not my dials.
Yeah.
And you're not paying for the electricity.
That's exactly right.
But you might get an additional add-on to her tuition.
Yeah, you might. I told her, I can't wait till you graduate from college. I get my squids back. Dad!
Yeah, right.
Okay, right.
How many?
She's probably not going to get them back.
Isn't this her last year?
This is her last semester. Ooh. She's already been there 4 years. But she had one extra semester because...
Wait a minute. 4 years has already gone by?
Yeah. She double majored. So, and of course they screwed up.
Didn't you just start high school like last week?
Okay. No, I still remember when he couldn't make it into the show because his daughter was being born.
Yep. Yep. No.
Heck with going off to school.
Yep. The soul's older than your daughter.
I remember the discussions on teaching her how to drive.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. She is looking at PhD programs now.
Wow.
In places like Edinburgh and Waco, Texas. Told her don't go there.
I have connections in Edinburgh.
Do you?
Yeah, my friend Ewan.
Okay. Is he in whatever the university is?
Well, he's in Macedon, but he knows people. In fact, his daughter is going going to one of the
good. If that's where she ends up going, I'll we'll have a
daughter. I forget
a name
which one
to give her.
Yeah,
and then she's also looking at Berkeley, not Berkeley, but somewhere in California, and the U of R. So my hope is that she ends up at the U of R.
Hmm. At least the squids will come home.
Exactly.
Maybe.
No, she'll go live in her own apartment somewhere, but so I'll never see those squids again. My poor squids, I'll never see them again. But the Power Squid is a cool toy.
Looks like the Home Depot sells a knockoff brand of Power Squid.
Everybody sells them. Yeah. I just want mine back.
Yep.
They're only about $16-$20, whatever they are.
Well, that's only got five outlets on it. That's not enough.
That's not enough.
Well, yeah, they just, matter of fact, they just set up in the break room a shelf that folks can now power, you know, when they get in there, their phones and that, they've got all the different little adapters for their tablets and that, if they want a quick charge up, you know, their phone or that type of stuff and do it.
That's one of Samsung's new commercials hitting the iPhone, calling iPhone users wall huggers.
Oh, yeah, the wall huggers.
Because they're always looking for that outlet.
My favorite one is the guy, the hipster on trying to desperately plug in his iPhone, looks up at somebody with a Samsung Galaxy S5, thank you, and looks at them and says, "What are you doing?" as they pull the back of their phone off. "I'm changing the battery." "You can change the battery? Like, how stupid are you? You've never seen anybody change a battery in your life?"
And how many batteries do you lose out of the remote, too?
Well, exactly. I don't think iPhone users are that dumb.
Well, I saw another commercial for the S5. That it showed about the camera. I was telling Kathy we got to look into it because supposedly the guy's going to take a picture and they're going, "Oh no, this is going to be too dark." And he hit something else that will auto adjust.
It's auto white balance. Cameras have had that forever. But the processing power in phones now is so great that the software can make up for very low light. Right. So we're seeing that each generation of phone can do better and better.
It's more than white balance.
Yeah.
It's enhancement of dark areas.
Yes.
Which is different from white balance.
So we got to do that thing called, go online and read some of the features.
Or I'll just show you on my phone. Okay. And you can do burst mode where it takes four shots at once. So if your kid is diving into the water.
She's already dangerous enough with that phone.
Yeah.
Sit there and
it's amazing. I bought from Linda, and I have to say I love it.
We go along on the motorcycle, and she can sit there and now rest her phone up on top of my helmet.
Yeah.
And going click, 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 click. She found another button. You don't even have to touch the screen. Evidently, you can touch one of the outer buttons, and you can go click, 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 click.
The volume.
Like, what would work better if she bought a GoPro?
GoPro?
Yeah, it's a little camera that's designed to be rugged.
And
helmet
mounted.
Helmet mounted.
No, she doesn't need that. No.
I'm looking for one of those that has cellular transmission built in or some way we can do live video streaming. Because most of the GoPros, they record to SD and then you play them later.
Right.
We've got a customer that wants to do live video. I found the company that sells police car outfit kits.
Nice.
And so you can put six cameras in your police car and there's a DVR in the trunk.
Right. But you can buy SD cards that have wireless in them.
Right. And then put a Wi-Fi router in and figure out a way to link between them.
Right. Or cellular. You can get them with cellular as well.
Cellular router is what I meant. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we were talking about how many frames per second. My Kodak camera, I've got a 4 frames per second and a 9 frames per second. So launching rockets, that big rocket we finally launched. So I got one frame with a little bit of smoke. Second frame where it's flying. Third frame, it's gone. Yeah. Fourth frame gone yet.
They move quick.
They go really quick.
Mm-hmm. They really are designed more for your kid is jumping in the pool or your dog is catching a frisbee. They're not really designed for rockets.
Well, the 9 frame per second takes, that's one complaint I have about this camera. It takes a long time to write to disk.
Yeah.
So the 9 frames per second, I missed the next two launches.
Yeah. Oops.
Because it takes that long to put 9 frames on the disk.
Yeah, but you don't care because it's your kid's launch.
Yeah.
That's really what counts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's they're just getting better and better and better with this stuff.
It's unbelievable.
It really is. It used to be, and a lot of that is due to Apple. Apple put high-end components in their first iPhone.
Yeah.
Now, I have to say this. Many other companies have caught up or surpassed them now.
That's the typical Apple thing. They come out with something really great. They sit back too slow, and the other guys catch them up and pass them.
That's exactly right. But they put in... Nobody cared about even if you had a camera in your cell phone. But if you did, it was cheap, it was low-end, nobody cared. Apple made people care.
Yep.
Look at the great picture I've taken with my camera. Is there music playing? Because I can't hear it, if it is.
No. He's about to hit the button, I think.
Okay.
And because that cameras and cell phones are getting so good, the point-and-shoot camera industry has died.
Yeah.
Almost nobody buys a regular little point-and-shoot camera.
Yep. And the other thing is, that's one of the reasons I just bought a 64 gig card for my phone because you want to be able to take all those pictures. You want to be able to take all that stuff. And the lovely thing about a Samsung phone is I can change that card.
Yep.
So I can have an infinite number of 64 gig slots. We're going to take a break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. 40 minutes after the hour, Soundbites member supported Jazz 90.1.
Computer talk you can understand. More Soundbites is next on member supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 43 minutes after the hour, we're just grooving to the music on Soundbites. Online dating site OkCupid is laughing in the face of Facebook's human experimentation scandal, lauding its own efforts today in a blog post on OK Trends. The post, it probably didn't come up today, I just saw it this yesterday, actually. The post, titled, "We Experimented on Human Beings," reminds us that if you use the internet, you're the subject of hundreds of experiments at any given time on every site. That's how websites work. Then it proceeds to brag about messing with people's emotions for the sake of science. OkCupid performed 3 studies on its users without telling them, the results of which range from depressing to obvious. One called Love is Blind, or Should Be, found out that, and here's a shocker, people are shallow, at least the people on OkCupid. Users planting the seeds of love via perfectly productive conversations with faceless potential lovers stopped talking to one another once OkCupid restored pictures to the accounts that had been blind. See, they normally you see a picture of somebody and you go talk to them on OkCupid. Right?
Okay.
Here, they didn't have a picture, so you were talking to them blind.
Oh.
And when they put the picture, people stopped talking. Because...
Ew.
And that, they're saying, is the scientific basis of Tinder's popularity, because you don't know who the hell you're talking to.
Mm-hmm.
In another, the power of suggestion, OkCupid finds that the company's algorithm doesn't work. People with high matches tend to have conversations and therefore go on dates with each other, which makes sense. You're more likely to respond to somebody with 90% compatibility. But that's not because OkCupid's questionnaire has discovered the secrets of matchmaking. It's because people will talk to other people that OkCupid has deemed are a high match. We took pairs of bad matches, actual 30% matches.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, your questionnaire, woman's questionnaire... Yeah. Only match 30%.
Yeah, they're not even probably, you know.
Right. And told them they were exceptionally good for each other by displaying a 90% match. OkCupid's Christian Rutter explains. And he clearly has no Christian Rutter, but okay, that's another story. When we tell people they are a good match, they act as if they are, even when they should be, wrong for each other. Of course, anyone who's ever used OkCupid knows it's a numbers game. Match percentages simply offer a filtering mechanism. Again, this isn't particularly shocking. It is, however, somewhat surprising that OkCupid is being so forthcoming about something some people might deem unethical. It should be noted that OkTrends, which was on a three-year hiatus until this post, was once an incredibly popular company blog with hits like The Real Stuff White People Like and The Best Questions on a First Date. OkCupid has always had a cavalier attitude about experimenting on users, and nobody seems to care. So, are you shocked that OkCupid performed unethical experiments? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-790-04.
Well, it's probably all based on questions, Ned, anyway.
Yeah, the questionnaire. Yeah. And even two people who have...
They like to go to the movies. You like to go for walks.
Well, yeah, completely opposite political views or social views. Yeah. They might have something in common. You know, we collect thumbnail or
likes going out, likes cooking, you know. Yeah, all that type of stuff.
But everything else, they're completely opposite.
I'd rather talk to somebody I'm not well matched to. Give you something to talk about.
Or argue about.
I mean, for some things, you know, I like to go to the movies. I want to be with someone who wants to go to the movies, too.
Right.
Okay. But
then
you know,
what kind of movie it comes up?
Well, but that's right. I mean, so some of that stuff you want to be compatible with. Other stuff I don't want to be compatible with because then we got stuff to talk about.
Yep.
True.
I'm sorry. I'm just that weird sort of person who actually feels at some point on a date, and I know this is radical, but at some point on a date, you are actually going to have to talk to the other person. I know.
What a concept.
I know.
Darn. You might have discovered something there. You might have hit on something.
Maybe we'll start a site called TalkingCupid.com. Dates where you can talk to each other.
Oh, boy.
I don't know if the world's ready for that.
No.
All right, we better go back to the phones. Our next caller is Ed from Henrietta, New York. Welcome, Ed. What's up?
Hi, gentlemen. I don't know if you can hear me. It sounds like kind of a bad connection. But anyway,
sounds okay at this end.
It's about Microsoft 7. At work, we got some new monitors. They're Dell computers. And I went in, and it's like it's all whited out. It's real. The background is real, real light, and it's tough to see. When you're typing anything, the font, you can almost see the pixels there. The fonts are so, you know, they're just not dark enough. And my question is there a way to personalize that so that you could, like, for example, on the taskbar, there used to be on the old monitor sort of like a blue background so you could see the buttons when they come up. Now everything is all whited out. You can see like a
but
black
outline.
Right. It may not be the computer. It may be the monitor.
Yeah, you might want to go into the contrast of
Right, yeah, but not on the computer, on the monitor.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. In the monitor, there's buttons that you can set on the actual monitor. They might have the contrast and the brightness cranked right on up there that it's really washed out for you.
No, I did that. Right, right. But it's just like it's an overlay. It's the colors. Is there a personalized button so you can go into the monitor and, you know, do something to it so you can bring the colors back and make them more vibrant?
Well, there's two places that you can do that. One is the monitor itself, and one is on the computer. I don't know what monitors you have. I can't lead you to that.
Yeah.
But in Windows, if you go into the control panel under displays, you should be able to make... all kinds of little changes.
Mm-hmm.
One thing you might, and this could take some experimentation. I can't lead you right to it, but that you can change the order of the RGB pixels. You can change the contrast. You can change the size of the screen. When you got these new screens, are they the same size as the old ones?
Oh, yeah. They're identical. We used to have a long time ago. A couple years ago, XP, and they changed that, of course, as you know, and now we just have Microsoft 7.
Right.
But this, it's like a Byzantine kind of a thing. It takes you forever to find out what you want to do, and they changed the taskbar, blah, 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 mm-hmm. you know, with the
how many colors are you displaying?
But right, it may be that the monitor settings are only set to 16 colors instead of 32-bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you got to go in there.
That's control
under
panels,
the display.
Appearance and personalization, adjust screen resolution.
Right.
So you would say the best way to go in is to the, I'm sorry, you said the, I'm writing down control panel and then go into what? The RGB contrast?
Appearance and personalization.
Mm-hmm.
And then adjust screen resolution.
Okay.
And then advanced. And you want to make sure you set the pixel dimensions right, 1920 by 1080, whatever the monitor is,
mm-hmm.
And the color depth, at least 24-bit, if not 32-bit color depth.
24. Can you go more than 24?
Yeah, go to 32.
32 if it has it.
If the monitor will take it.
Yeah. Oh, but if good. These are new monitors, they should.
They should. There shouldn't be an issue.
I think that's probably it. I'll bet you it's the 24 or less. Good, good. Okay, I'll give that a shot. Thanks a lot.
Now, hold on. Yeah. We are going to post that on our website at soundbites.org. So if you didn't quite write it all down, it'll be there shortly.
And there's also a section on the color profile, which is how the colors are displayed, called the color gamut. Which is how the colors can be displayed. So you have to match the profile the computer's putting out to the gamut the monitor is capable of.
Gotcha.
And that section is available.
And you can also change the background colors, you know, if you want something.
Yeah, there, but you just hit the point, and that's exactly what I need to do because now it's all washed out in the background. So when you're writing, the work order, you can't, you know, you just can't see what you're.
Yeah,
you can,
try changing. You'll be able to change that too.
Okay, and that's soundbites.org, right?
Yep.
Hey, thanks a lot, Jeff.
That'll be up there in just a couple minutes.
Beautiful. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Ed. Yeah, one of the issues that you generally don't have with laptops is monitor compatibility.
Right.
Because they do all that for you before you get it. But when you own a desktop where you can change the monitor willy-nilly.
Especially if IT just pulled the old monitor off and stuck the new monitor on.
Without doing anything.
Without doing anything. Setting resolution, setting, you know, the right settings for this new monitor.
Although they're probably getting complacent and thinking, it'll automatically do it. It'll be fine.
He said something about the you could almost see the pixels on screen. That makes me think he's running it at too high a resolution. It should be lower.
Yep. Right.
So that the typical with LCDs, there's something called the native resolution where the pixels are actual size. If you run something at a lower resolution, everything on screen looks bigger, but everything is pixelated and you can see the edges of the pixels because it's not the native resolution.
Right.
If you need things on screen to look bigger, you go into the control panels and set a zoom layer. You don't make your resolution lower.
One thing we should talk about, and this is, you know, talking about all these different things that we recommend to people every day, is something that we got coming up on the 30th. What's coming up on August 30th?
You forgot.
No, I couldn't figure out how that has something to do with what we recommend to people every day.
Well, because, no, advice that we've been doing for over 25 years. Get with the program.
I know what comes up on the 30th. I didn't understand how it related to something.
I was trying to...
Your segue, man.
Yeah, I was trying to... Give me a break,
EC. Anti-segue man.
I was trying to make a...
Look, here's how you do segue.
I give up.
That reminds me. On August...
No, I'm going to shut you off now. You're done. You're shut off.
Look, we've been doing this for way too long. We're like old married trio. That doesn't work. Well, the reality here is that on August 30th, we are celebrating our 25th anniversary. The actual anniversary is the 3rd, but it's going to be one Saturday or the other. We picked the 30th. Because the 3rd is a Wednesday, and we will be at the Lovin' Cup, performing live at the Lovin' Cup. So we'll be right there on stage taking live questions from the audience and messing about as we never have done before in our lives, of course. We're always so serious about this show.
You make it so hard.
So I'm personally looking forward to it. I'm just gonna have fun that day. I don't care what anybody says. And it's a great place. They have great food and beverages, and I'm just gonna enjoy it.
Get caught up on, like I say, 25 years that we've seen go by, and just like this, the previous caller, you know, again, we've been doing it so long. You can actually, and I know it's the same for you two guys.
Yep.
You can sit there in your mind and see where he's got to go. And folks will sit there. How do you do that? Well, when you've been doing it as long as we have, you can sit there and visualize what the person has to do and go in and do it.
And that's why we hate when Microsoft or Apple changes the way things look.
Oh, yeah.
We remember the old way. We don't want to remember new ways.
Right.
Yeah. But
we're now getting old. We don't want to put that kind of stuff in our brain anymore.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's amazing how far we've come. And I was thinking about that again. Somebody stopped by and was asking a question. And going back to the old DOS days, and Edlin.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. I actually had to edit a file in Edlin not that terribly long ago. I just took a deep breath, brought it up, and my hands remembered what to do. I couldn't tell you how to save the file with a gun to my head, but I said, okay, now I got to save it, and I just did it, and it was done.
It's amazing, you know. Like I say, I think we've forgotten more stuff than we've remembered.
I've forgotten more stuff since Tuesday.
Because I remember the days when I was so excited at Kodak when we... this was before they even got the first PCs in. We had a Trash 80.
Oh, yeah.
And I went out to a Tandy and bought some 8-inch floppies because they held a whole 32K. And we could sit there and program. We could program on those. It's like, darn, this is going to be cool. You know, yeah, it had a lot of fun.
It's one thing we don't do anymore is program. Kids don't have access to something like BASIC so that they can learn... to actually
now it's
program.
It's Perl and JavaScript and Ruby.
Perl is fine. Yeah. You can learn to program in Perl. In fact, I'm brushing up on my Perl skills because I'm teaching a class this year. And that's fine, but you don't even get that on a computer. You can install it,
right?
But it used to be computers came with BASIC.
Yeah.
Now, you may hate BASIC, whatever, but it introduced an awful lot of people, an entire generation, to programming.
Fundamentals. I've always said that's why I'm better at fixing computers, because I was a programmer. I know how they're supposed to work.
Right. Yeah, it makes logical sense to us.
So when they don't work that way.
But Apple killed Apple BASIC. Microsoft no longer puts MS BASIC on their machines. Mm-hmm. And there's your majority of systems. Yep. I have Linux boxes. I can get Perl. I can get GBASIC. I can get any one of 100 languages on it. But most systems, Chromebooks don't have it. iPads don't have it. At least they don't have languages.
Well, I can remember loading Turbo Pascal on disk onto a PC.
Yep. Right.
Yeah.
The Mac does have some of those built in because it's also Unix. So there's Perl in there and Python.
Right.
I haven't gotten into any of the new programming languages.
No, me neither. I mean, my last one that I did was PL1.
Yeah, I remember taking PL1.
PL1, you know, and I've done Cobalt, Fortran, and all those, but
my college didn't accept the 7 computer languages I took as part of my language requirement. They wanted me to take a human language.
What the heck is that all about?
That's why I never got around to graduating.
All right, listen. I think we've had enough fun for this hour. But you know what? We're going to do it all over again because we're gluttons for punishment. We'll be back. This hour is over, but we'll be back with a whole nother hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. You'll have more, way too much of Dave Enright, more of Steve Ray, more of Nick Francesco, more of all of you. Give us a call. If you're on the line, stay on the line. We'll get to you after the break. If you're not on the line, give us a call. We'll be putting you on the line as well. And we'll be back with a whole lot more sound bites on the truly great and solely member-supported Jazz 90.1. See you on the other side.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Hi, I'm Nick Francesco. Along with Dave Enright and Steve Ray, I host Soundbites, America's longest-running computer talk show. We're celebrating 25 years on the air, Saturday, August 30th, from 12 noon to 2 p.m., with a live broadcast at Love & Cup, located at Park Point at RIT. Food and beverage will be available for purchase. For more information on this event, you may visit jazz901.org.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Take it away, Segway Man.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 5 minutes after the hour, We are sound bites. Speaking of a weekend in the Bahamas, we have Steve from Greece on the line. Welcome, Steve. What's up?
I've been compared to a weekend in the Bahamas. I'm impressed. Thank you, guys.
Sure.
He's busting my chops.
One of them you just generated.
The what happened?
You just generated one of my two questions that I have for you guys today.
Uh-oh.
A trip to the Bahamas?
About making the displays bigger.
Yeah.
You mentioned a zoom layer. Now, I know a zoom layer in Photoshop, but I don't know a zoom layer on my computer monitor.
Which operating system are you running?
Well, I'm running 7, but you just had this person on who was had the monitor issue.
Yeah, he's running Windows 7.
And, well, that's what I'm running. I'm 7 Ultimate. And just as you were logging off, ending that conversation, you mentioned that
rather than making the resolution smaller, which, ironically, you make the numbers bigger, that makes the resolution smaller.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You can set the zoom level. It's in the display preferences. I'm trying to bring up the page again. And there's a setting for extra large fonts. There's a setting for zoom level where everything on screen will be bigger, but you're still at the native resolution of the monitor.
Okay, which is what you want to be, of course.
Yeah.
There are actually two magnifying modes. One is full screen magnification, and one is something called lens magnification.
Okay.
Yeah, if you want to just magnify a little piece of the screen versus the whole screen.
Right, so you move your mouse around, and what's under the mouse looks bigger.
All my years on the computer, I actually never knew that zoom layers was in there.
Yeah, it's not called zoom layers specifically, but yes.
Okay. And now, I've actually called on this before, and you are helpful, but I'm going to ask you to help me again.
No, forget it. We did it once before.
I'm looking for OCR software, and I don't know how my internet searches, Bing, Google. I mean, I've used a ton of different search engines, Sweet Search, all kinds of stuff. I cannot find a good commercial, or what I think is a good commercial OCR program, and I don't know how to get reviews. None of the computer magazines do that. I get Maximum PC and PC Computing. Right, yeah. I've never seen anything on OCR.
Yeah. Well, OCR is kind of a dying fad because everything is digital to begin with, so we don't need the OCR much anymore. Oftentimes when you buy a scanner, it will come with OCR software.
Right, mine did, but it's just...
Abbey Fine Print is a common one. Read Iris is another common one. And Omni is probably the granddaddy. Nuance has been buying all of the other OCR and dictation software, too. So it's OCR and dictation are kind of two ends of the same spectrum. And Nuance, and UANCE, has purchased... most of those programs.
If you're looking for something free, there's one called Open OCR from a company called Cognitive. It's also called Cuneiform, but there's one called Free OCR, another called Free OCR to Word, and another called Simple OCR, which you may want to look at. Those are free. I honestly don't know how well they work. They've all gotten good ratings.
But, Dave, you went through a whole list, but you went through it much quicker than my pen moves.
Read Iris.
Okay.
Abbey Fine Print. Abbey with two Bs.
Okay.
And OmniPage.
Yeah, OmniPage is like Steve said, the grandfather of all.
It's like $500.
Wow.
Right.
I want good, but I guess I don't want quite that good.
Well, and there are some free ones. One called Cognitive Open OCR. Open OCR is all one word. So Cognitive Open OCR, which is also called Cuneiform.
Is that a K?
No, with a C. Cuneiform, as in the type of writing they used in ancient Greece.
Okay.
Probably I'm pronouncing it badly. Egypt. What did I say?
Greece.
No, Egypt. Thank you. Another one is called FreeOCR. Again, all one word.
Right.
There's one called FreeOCR to Word, and those are all separate words. And then one called SimpleOCR, again, one word.
I know that many years ago, we're going back to 30 meg hard drives. Xerox had an excellent, excellent
Xerox
OCR
Text Bridge.
Program.
Yeah, I think it got purchased by Nuance and killed.
Okay.
Wikipedia has a list of a couple of dozen OCR programs and what OSs they run on.
Actually, I'd never thought of going to Wikipedia.
Tesseract.
There are so many. Yeah, Tesseract.
Screenworm.
Wikipedia has so much stuff you don't think it will have.
Right.
It might be good. Steve will put that link to that list on our website, and then
it's got Abbey Reader, but it doesn't have OmniPage.
Right. It'll never have everything. Well, this might be free ones.
No, there's OmniPage. Sorry. No, it's right. Got free and commercial.
But anyway, those are just some choices. The a lot of places nowadays obviously don't use much paper anymore. But if you want to get old stuff in the archives, you can just scan them to PDF. But that's not the same as being able to search them
right.
And do other stuff with them. So OCR is a much better choice for that. The problem with OCR is that it's about 99% accurate.
That's why we got to go with a good one.
Well, but that's 99% accurate still means one out of 100 characters
right.
Is wrong. And that means in every three lines of text, you're going to have two wrong characters.
Yep.
And God forbid you've got a spreadsheet in there somewhere.
Oh.
So you're usually better off hiring a temp to type it.
Well, you can certainly, and it does depend entirely on the types of documents, but if they're strictly text documents, you can do the OCR and then go back through them and edit.
Right.
If it's 12-point Monaco even spaced on a black text on a white background, it'll come out pretty good.
Right, but if it's the third generation carbon of something that was done on an IBM Selectric in 1963, you might be better off just crumpling it and throwing it in a corner.
Well, part of the reason is I've got some manuscripts that were typed on a typewriter.
Uh-huh.
And I would much rather scan them in.
Yeah.
Then sit there with my Dragon, naturally speaking. And
nope, absolutely agree.
Do you have a scanner now, or are you going to buy a scanner?
I have a brother, and I was not planning on buying a separate
scanner. Is it an all-in-one or a separate scanner?
It's an all-in-one, it's a three-in-one.
Yeah, separate scanners often have OCR software. It comes with the scanner, mm-hmm. But the all-in-ones usually don't.
Yeah. Or you might have to go to the website. Just like they don't include the manual anymore.
Maybe, yeah.
If you go to the website for that particular manufacturer, you might be able to get the OCR software from there. Because, again, it costs some money to produce those discs,
right.
But you might be able to go to their website and download the OCR software for that particular unit for free. Yeah. It's worth checking out.
It does actually have OCR, but it's one page at a time, and you must reset it after every page. I want to be able to take, scan a chapter, and then, I understand what you're saying. Thank you, gentlemen. Yep. I know it's a little early, but happy birthday. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
25 years is very impressive.
The loving cup and the 30th are right around the corner.
Yep.
I say longer than my first marriage.
That's right.
Fuji makes a line of scanners called SnapScan. That are specifically designed for double-sided OCR, they're $500. They're not inexpensive, but they're double-sided scanning. So you give it a stack of papers, hit scan, and come back in a few minutes. It's scanned to both sides of the paper. It's OCR'd it, and you get a Word file.
Nice.
I wonder if any of these services, like over at say Staples or somewhere like that, that could do something like that instead of
Well, but again, they'll charge you.
Oh, yeah, but what I'm saying
is, how much you have, it'll cost you more than $500.
Yeah.
It depends on how much you have.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, whether it's instead of buying this, you know, the scanner and all that, but if he's already got it, and like I say, if he can't get the software, you got to weigh different options because right. There are places out there that could quick, with these higher end copiers and all that, copy it on in and maybe save it, yep. You know, to OCR.
I used to work at a translation company, and we translated product manuals for copiers, and we had a $20,000 Kurzweil scanner OCR engine. And then after we scanned the manual, we still had people go through it and read pretty yeah. much every oh, word yeah. to make sure it scanned right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, because it's not perfect.
Yep.
I mean, OCR, and especially, like you said,
Should we go back a step and explain what OCR is for our younger audience?
Yeah, character recognition. Basically, what we're talking about
here... It's a reverse printer.
Yeah, exactly. It's a reverse printer. What it does is it takes a printed page... recognizes each character optically, mm-hmm. that is to say with a camera of some sort, and then turns that picture of a character back into the character. So if you had the word sound bites, it would read that and say, oh, that's an S, so I'll put an S in the document. That's an O, that's a U. Mm-hmm. And it would take that and actually translate it from a picture or a PDF or whatever back into actual text on the page.
Because most of the time, in fact, all the time, when you scan a document with your scanner, it's a picture of the document. It's not really text.
Right.
So what this does is then OCR will translate that back into text. And what we're saying is most of them nowadays, as long as you've got a fairly clean copy in a fairly decent font, you get about 99% accuracy, which sounds like a lot,
mm-hmm.
but in point of fact, that means every three lines you're going to have two mistakes.
Right. You've got to go in and proofread. There's no guarantee that it's going to be 100%, no way get out.
Right. So, again, if you've got pictures, if you've got tables, if you've mm-hmm. got spreadsheets, you really just want to redo them by hand.
Yeah.
Because the spreadsheet won't bring the formulas over anyway. It only brings over the numbers.
Well, that's where he was getting into, and that's another option for folks, is drag and dictate. You know, that's another, or they've got other software out there where you can talk to your computer.
Right.
And it will translate what you're talking and convert it to, you know, text. Right. I mean, you can do that on your cell phone nowadays. And even that
I can do it on my Chromebook. It's very, software to do that.
That technology has come light years. Because I can remember before you had to spend at least an hour or so sitting there training the computer to your voice. And God help you if you had a cold or anything else.
Yeah.
Because then it was like, don't bother doing work that day because it's not going to recognize what you were saying because your whole speech pattern changes. And once you got it set up, it was good. Slow. But nowadays...
And you had to be careful how you spoke.
Right. You have to speak very clearly, period, and enunciate very clearly, period, new paragraph.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and now you can do that on your cell phone, no problem.
Well, you know why?
Yeah.
Because Google's smarter than heck.
Yeah, it is.
And what they did was they introduced Google Voice. And Google Voice transcribed mm-hmm. Text voice messages to text and sent them to you as a text. And then anything that it might not have understood,
mm-hmm.
it allowed you to correct.
Yep.
And when you corrected it, that went back to Google so they could learn and understand better.
Well, it's even brilliant. Even if it's in doubt, it'll sit there and come up with some suggestions.
Right. And in fact, Google is asking people, did I take that as one of my stories? I don't think so. Google is asking people to help with translations again to make it.
Well, even on Google Translate, translate.google.com, which translates like sentences or even whole websites, you can fix the translation and make the translation engine better.
Right. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 19 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe, coming up on 25 years. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. We already did that. Right here on Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 24 minutes after the hour, we are sound bites. Here's the newest Facebook fiasco. Facebook has already begun a rollout where they will stop allowing messaging in its main iPhone and Android apps and force all their users around the world to download its standalone Messenger app. Facebook first started requiring users in Europe to use its Messenger back in April, but after seeing positive results, quote unquote, in terms of engagement, it's rolling out the plan to everyone. Facebook says people on Messenger reply about 20% faster, and not supporting multiple versions of mobile chat will help it make both main apps and Messenger better. Mobile web, iPad, feature phone, Windows phone, paper, and desktop users can still message in their main Facebook apps or sites like before and will be spared from this forced migration for now. But iPhone and Android phone users will be forced to use the Messenger app. Previously, people could chat from a messages tab in Facebook smartphone apps. They also had the option to download Messenger, which would turn the messages tab into a notification hub and shortcut that would fast switch users into Messenger when tapped. Soon, though, iPhone and Android users will be forced into this bouncing around. They'll get a few optional notices to download Messenger before the chat eventually stops working in the main app. Facebook will also send an email to people the change will impact that explains why it's happening. That little clock-wielding otter in the notification about the switch is cute, but he's definitely going to annoy a lot of people. In what could be viewed as an attempt to avoid too much press attention, Facebook declined to publish a blog post about the change. Instead, it's notifying users directly and published an official statement. In the next few days, we're continuing to notify more people that if they want to send and receive Facebook messages, they'll need to download the Messenger app. As we've said, our goal is to focus development efforts on making Messenger the best possible messaging experience possible and avoid the confusion of having separate Facebook mobile messaging experiences. Messenger is used by more than 200 million people every month, and we'll keep working to make it an even more engaging way to connect with people. While the rationale of the forced migration might be logical, it doesn't mean it sits well with users. Some people might simply not want to worry about managing two different Facebook apps. Others might have enjoyed the chat heads interface that allowed message multitasking so they could chat over the top of what they were doing. So, will this change annoy you? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or toll free 1-800-790-0415.
The only time I ever use that is when I'm actually sitting at my computer. Otherwise, it's usually texting.
Yeah, Facebook is not the place I spend most of my time.
Yeah, me neither. You know, I mean, it's usually... If somebody wants to get a hold of me, they'll throw me a text.
I know, I get it. I get it.
Yeah, but I see more folks using texting than any, you know, I would think than Facebook.
Yeah.
I don't know. That maybe it's just me.
No, I'm with you. I get it. It's a thing.
Is that just showing our age?
There's a generation of people that got on the internet using Facebook, and that's all they know the internet is.
So that's sort of like us with AOL.
Yeah, AOL. AOL was the internet for a very long time.
We used to get all those discs and CDs.
Yep.
Countless discs. I came across a couple.
Yeah.
Go sorting out stuff.
You want to talk about a blast from the past?
Yeah.
I have a friend, and God love her. I think she's a sweetheart. I love her madly.
How does she put that on her resume?
Her email address is at Juno.
Oh, wow.
I've had a couple people with that. Yep, still at Juno. Net Zero.
Dang.
Yeah. Prodigy. Anyone still left using Prodigy?
Is that even still alive?
I doubt it.
Way to find out. Try
going it. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that was trying to be the rival of AOL.
Yeah, that stuff is amazing.
Oh, what was the other one that started up before AOL? Before
there was Genie.
CompuServe.
CompuServe.
Yes,
yeah.
CompuServe. They were actually the pioneers.
Well,
was the pioneer. But
you know, you have an early CompuServe address if it's all numbers.
Yep.
If there's letters in your CompuServe address, you came in later.
Yeah.
CompuServe, man.
I remember CompuServe. That's gone. I think Prodigy is gone. I think AOL probably absorbed them both.
Is it AOL still there, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. How are they making any money?
They've become a news portal for ads.
Oh, okay.
And they still offer dial up service if you still have a need for nationwide dial up service.
Which I bet you some folks still have to.
Yeah, but from what we have, what we've read, a lot of people are still paying for AOL because they forgot to cancel it.
I could not get off AOL.
Well, that's the other problem.
I spent a year not being able to get off AOL. I eventually closed the account.
Your credit card, yeah.
And they threatened to sue me.
Yeah.
I said, go ahead, sue me.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I've been trying to cancel for years.
Because I was not paying my bill. So I kept saying, cancel me.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I want out of you. The other day I was cleaning up and I found an AOL CD. Maybe I'll auction it off. We'll sign it. I'll auction it off on the 25th anniversary. We'll give the money to Jazz 90.1.
Oh, that'd be cool.
Let's plan on that.
Yeah.
I'll auction it off.
I wish we could find an old...
Just to the folks who were there, not over the
air. An old version of Windows. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We could sign that. And
yeah.
How much I used to love that product.
Yeah, you loved it dearly. Oh, I know that.
Did you follow any of the mess with Ryan Block trying to cancel his Comcast account?
Same idea. Yeah.
And some of it...
And he's at AOL.
No, he's Google.
Oh, yeah, he's Google.
He's Google. Right. Well, and because he's a big name, I think that's why it made a little more news than just some average guy trying to cancel it. But yeah, he created Dig. He got bought by Google. He's a heck of a guy.
He's
a VC now at Google, and he's trying to cancel his Comcast account because they're cutting the cord and doing everything on the internet. And so he said he started the recording 20 minutes into the phone call, and it goes on for another 20 minutes.
Yeah.
We want to cancel our account. No, how about you get this package? We want to cancel our account. Oh, how about this? We want to cancel our account. I can do this, but we want to cancel our account. And so apparently Comcast, some PR guy at Comcast came back. We apologize for the aggressiveness of
And then
behind the scenes he said, yeah, they're supposed to do that. It's called customer retention.
Yep.
We don't want you to leave.
Mm-hmm.
We offer the best service. No, you don't.
No, you really don't. And cord cutting is becoming the bane of the cable providers.
Yep.
Like Comcast. It's a terrible thing
Hulu?
For them.
Hulu and all that?
Hulu, and with like the Fox app and the CBS app and the TNT app, what a lot of these websites, content providers have started doing is you can watch the TNT app on your tablet, but only if your internet provider pays them.
Right.
So a lot of times, in fact, I was almost thinking that was the 13 Wham problem from Dennis last week.
Oh, yeah.
That you, in order to use, say, the Fox app on your tablet, you have to sign in to your Time Warner account. It's like to use the HBO app, you have to sign in to your Time Warner account mm-hmm. to verify that you're a Time Warner cable TV subscriber. But well, that's the whole point of ringing on the app. I don't want to subscribe on my TV.
Right. But if you want to go to abc.com and watch their shows or mm-hmm. or whatever, you can just do that.
On the web, yeah.
On the web.
Sometimes they still make you sign in, though.
Well, and now if you're one of those people who loves Marvel comics... And Netflix is bringing out 4 Marvel series
mm-hmm.
next year, and you can binge watch them.
Hmm.
Tay Diggs, American Rochester actor. I've met his mom. I've met him. Nice guy. I'm not watching his series right now because I missed the first 2 episodes,
mm-hmm.
and now they're so far into it, I can't catch up.
Oh, okay.
So I'm waiting until it appears on Netflix or on something where I can see the whole thing.
By the whole season
series. And what Netflix has pioneered with the Kevin Spacey
series, whatever it was called, and the Orange is the New Black, is they put out a whole season once. So you can watch them at your leisure, or you can binge watch them, or whatever it is you want to do. And, oh, by the way, think about this. They're up for, like, what, 8 Academy Awards this year? Emmy Awards, I mean, this year. There are networks who've never gotten 8 Emmy Awards in a year.
Well, one thing that's I noticed, a couple friends were telling me, that's become very common, is they're taking a laptop now, getting an HDMI cable, setting it right next to their TV, because they got the wireless internet, or they can even hardwire. I've heard some folks even hardwiring their laptop in, and they just go up to the internet, get that program, stream it right through their computer, right onto the screen, and boom, they can watch anything they want and not paying the cable company.
But that's why I bought a Chromecast, $35. Anything I can see on my desktop, on my Chromebook, on my phone, on my tablet, I can just cast it right to the TV and watch it there.
Sometimes, so on my iPad, I went to the Fox website. It will not let me stream video because I have to use the app. And in the app, I have to log into my Time Warner account. You should try it on your Chromebook because it knows it. So I have to use another browser that says I'm a desktop.
What is it, Fox.com?
Yeah. So your browser, I've watched full episodes. When you go to a browser, open your browser in Explorer, Firefox, Chrome, whatever, and go to a website, your browser tells the website what you're using. And the website can say, oh, we don't support Chrome. You have to use Internet Explorer.
You know what?
You're on a tablet? You can't do this. You have to go to our app.
You know what? That's going to waken up some hackers to sit there and, you know, like you used to be able to do
change your operating user system. Yeah.
Say, no, what are you looking for? Oh, I'm looking for this. Yeah, I'm that.
Yep. So I've got another browser where I can change my user agent.
Yeah, so, there's ways around it.
Apparently, they're working on it, but...
Yeah, I did that for a while.
It's going to let me see it.
Maybe. I got past that, and then as soon as I tried to hit play.
That's what I love about my Chromecast. I watched... What happened was my Blu-ray player died. And I thought, well, I can watch Blu-ray on my computer, because I have a Blu-ray player disc in my desktop.
Which you could then port right over to your TV.
Well, and I can, and that's got a decent sized monitor.
Oh, okay.
And then I can watch Netflix, but it's not ideal. And I can watch this and that, and I get a better experience on my tablet, but it's only 7 inches or 10 inches. I get a great experience on my new phone. Thank you, Linda. But
it's only
5 inches.
Yeah.
So I got the Chromecast. And now any one of those, I just hit one button, bam, it's on my giant TV in full resolution.
Yep.
And I can watch it there.
Yeah, Netflix said they're going to start streaming 4K.
Yeah.
Oh, great. So people have to make 4K content. Now you have to have a 4K TV. And you better hope you don't have a bandwidth cap, because that's half a movie.
Oops.
Well, I'm still waiting for green light, and so that's what I'm waiting for.
Yeah, we were waiting for FiOS.
Oh, you've got that story about the super combination fiber. You download a movie in a tenth of a second.
Yeah, Danish researchers just created the Usain Bolt of networks. A team from the Technical University of Denmark used a single multi-core optical fiber, which is the same thing you get to your home. You can get to your home to transfer 43 terabytes per second, making it the world's fastest fiber network. Which that kind of makes, the ones that are out there now look like 1996.
Your Time Warner is 10 megabits.
Right, and this is 43 terabits.
So that's 43 million megabits?
Yeah. So how fast is that? Extreme Tech points out that means you can download a 1 gigabyte movie in 0.2 milliseconds. The average blink of an eye lasts between 100 and 400 milliseconds. You could download thousands of movies in the blink of an eye. Thousands of them, even if you're a particularly fast blinker. It's not exactly clear how the team pushed so much in so short a time. They may have used something similar to FlexiGrid, which is a way to speed up network connections over fiber that was developed earlier this year. FlexiGrid, though, does 1.4 terabits per second, which is not quite as much as 43 terabits per second. So we'll see what they have later on. But, and you know, they didn't set this record by rigging up some impossible-to-implement system. They used a single fiber from Japanese telecom company NTT, so their technique should be actually commercially viable. And so that's kind of awesome. This research could and should be used to set up way faster network connections. Going to take a break, back in just a couple of minutes. Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you, 39 minutes after the hour. Soundbites, member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Before you call into our show, please make note of the following rules. 1. Turn your radio down. 2. Turn your radio down lower. 3. Remember, nobody has invented a good-sounding speakerphone yet. Don't use them. 4. Make sure you have a point. It makes for a more interesting show. 5. Calling does not guarantee you'll get on the air. No whining. 6. If you do get on the air, please do not tell the host what you just told the screener. We don't care. And 7. Is that radio turned down yet? We hope this will make for a more enjoyable program, and we thank you for your time.
Computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, we are Sound Bites. The more I think of that, the more I like the idea of holding a little auction for the folks who are there.
Yeah.
And giving away some signed stuff and then donating the money to Jazz 90.1.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
I like that idea. On Thursday, the NFL, the National Football League, American football, not real football, announced in-game player tracking technology for 17 stadiums for the 2014 season. And while limited to a little more than half the buildings in the league, the NFL is doing things differently than other leagues. RFID, or RFID, tracking chips will be placed on every player at some point this season, two of them per player, to allow the NFL to measure something the NBA and NASCAR don't, player orientation. By that, we don't mean sexual or political, we mean which way are they facing. I don't know why.
Hopefully, yeah, really. Hopefully toward the other guy's end zone.
Yeah, really.
The league calls this initiative Next Generation Statistics, and they plan to pipe the insights primarily into stadiums hosting NFL's Thursday Night Football on the league's own television network, the NFL Network. From those 17 stadiums specifically, explains Vishal Shah, the NFL Vice President of Media Strategy, we will be capturing position and location-based data. Really, the focus and the genesis of this project was the ability to capture proprietary news statistics in real time, which is probably not the best idea. Oh, never mind. Then secondarily, to create fan experiences which have applications. Probably the most visual one is within the broadcast itself. The tech driving the analytical push, MotionWorks, is the same technology installed this year for NASCAR's Michael Waltrip racing practices. But it's actually not new. MotionWorks is a legacy business, initially developed for industrial manufacturing. Zebra, the maker of MotionWorks, developed the technology to measure distance within motion-based systems and improve safety and efficiency on factory floors about 10 years ago. Their technology was deployed all over the globe even before they began selling to pro sports leagues. At launch, MotionWorks will be used to augment television broadcasts and provide fans with statistics previously unavailable, even to teams and coaches. Missed blocks and turnovers will not simply be understood as missed assignments, but will be broken down by way of spatially orienting statistics that show fans who screwed up and where. And the coaches, too. So, is this a way to improve the fan experience, or is it just creating data for data's sake? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 1-800-790-0415.
Well, the NFL has a long history of players running the wrong way, going back to the 30s, and scoring for the other team. So maybe if they're going the wrong way, see, you can't get in. If they're going the wrong way, they're uniform will buzz at them or something.
Yeah, get an electrical shock.
Yeah, there we go.
Or a heads-up display will come up and says, go the other way.
Until we can get robots, this is the closest we're going to get. Yeah. But it's kind of interesting that they're doing this. I don't honestly quite understand the point.
Because they can?
Well, that's what I'm thinking. That was my point in the question I had. Is it just data for data's sake? Are we just saying, you know what would be cool? We can do this, so let's do this.
Well, they'll find a reason why. Yeah. So it's really big in sports games. The coaches analyze all the video from the game to see what didn't work, what did work. So this would be, you know, another data point for them. Here you know if he'd have zigged instead of zagged, you might have got another yard.
Right. No, and I do get that, but you know, really, at this point, at least, it sounds like a solution in search of a problem.
Yeah.
But maybe they'll find a problem to give it to. So, you know, that's fine too. Whatever. But we'll see.
I was reading a story. Scott Sigler, he's a sci-fi horror writer. He has a series on the Galactic Football League.
Oh, sure.
And this one human quarterback gets called up to the big leagues. And they're all aliens. The defensive backs are 12 feet long and literally want to eat you.
Yep.
They can bench press 1,000 pounds. The running backs are little green balls of fur that can jump 15 meters in the air. And so this poor human is just way out of his league and has to learn the new ways to play football.
Right.
It's really interesting stories.
All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Lynn from Clymer, New York. Welcome, Lynn. What's up?
I just have a question for you on this nice Saturday afternoon. I have a little conundrum. I recently lost all of my Clear Channel iHeartRadio stations from my Wi-Fi radios, and I've come up with a workaround for the time being where I have a little small FM transmitter, and I can plug that into my computer, bring it up on the computer, and then I can send it off to my bedroom so I can have my favorite channel at night when I'm going to sleep. I can do it that way, but I'd like to be able to terminate that link at a reasonable hour in the night so it works like a sleep timer. And I remember many years ago, Nick, you speaking about you could do all kinds of things with an at command, and I don't know if that still exists. I have no idea how it works or whatever. But I thought maybe I could close out the browser that I was running iHeartRadio in, and that way it would terminate it, and then the computer could go to sleep.
Yeah, there is a program, there is a command called at, in Windows, and using the at command, you can say, at such and such a time, do X. So it essentially, at such and such a time, run a batch file, right?
And then I got to write a batch file.
So then you write a batch file. Well, it depends on what it is you're doing. You know, but basically you can do pretty much anything that you can do in a batch file, or you could start a program. So you can do any of that stuff. So for example, it's similar to there's a capability in Linux called crontab, and it's the cron table. The cron command lets you do things at a certain time, and the at command is essentially the same. So, for example, one of the things that I do is at noon every Saturday, I start a program called MPlayer that connects to the Jazz 90.1 stream, records it to my computer, and then at 2 o'clock, I kill that command.
Mm-hmm.
And so I get a 2-hour block of the show.
Yep.
Now, you would be able to do something very similar to that using the at command under Windows. Use one at command to start the program and another at command to kill it. How you kill it is the issue I don't have in my head.
Oh.
Right, because I don't know what program you're using. It may have an end command. The program, you should take a look at whatever program you're using.
Well, it'd be in the browser.
Okay, well, but you don't have to do it in the browser.
Oh, okay.
Right? If all they're doing in the browser is giving you a stream that you could get elsewhere.
Oh, I could put it in VLC.
That's my point. And maybe in VLC there's a, and I don't remember because I don't use VLC this way. I use MPlayer. Mm-hmm. But VLC may have a something similar to what MPlayer does, which is you can say record this for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And you might be able to find in the iHeartRadio apps on Android and iOS, there are sleep timers built in. So instead of playing it from your computer, if you can play it from a mobile device, there's a sleep timer already in the app, so it will play for X minutes and then shut itself off.
Mm-hmm. Except I don't have any other. I have computers and I have Wi-Fi radios. That's the extent of my
You're behind the mobile device generation?
Yeah.
My neighbor gives me heck about that.
Yeah.
Can't believe you don't have a smartphone. I don't use a phone that much. Why should I spend that kind of money for something that I would use only once in a while?
Right.
What about just setting a sleep time in Windows itself? Can you force it to go to sleep at a certain time? I know you can on the Mac.
Well, I don't know how good that is if you're playing something and then you just shut Windows down. How good that's.
Well, Windows should tell the browser to shut down, and the browser.
You would think so.
Yeah. It should.
But at any rate, Steve has posted a beginner's tutorial on the at command, and there are bunches of them all over the internet. It's still in Windows 7, I know for sure. Probably in Windows 8.
Which I don't have.
Right.
I'll be going to 9, 7, or, yeah.
Right, the odd-numbered ones.
Yes.
Right, it's like Star Trek. So my suggestion is you want to check that out and play around with it. It's really, the at command is very, very powerful to let you do things at specific times. So, for example, you could back up your whole computer at 2 a.m. while you're asleep.
Oh.
You know, I mean, so mm-hmm. you can do pretty much anything you want to do as long as you know how to do it.
Yeah.
That's at the command line. Right. Anyway, give that a try.
Yep. Okay.
All right, thanks. Well, that brings us to the end of another show. We want to thank all of you who called in. Please don't forget, August 30th, we will be live at the Lovin' Cup. That's going to be about the most fun you can have with your clothes on, so we're looking forward to that. Don't go away, however. George is coming in to play the best German music you'll hear all week. Michael is clearly dreading trying to keep him in line today. But we're done. Thanks to Dave Enright, Steve Ray. I'm Nick Francesco. It's Soundbites on the truly great and solely member-supported Jazz 90.1. See you next week.